This is All Things Considered. I'm Linda Wertheimer, and I'm Marcia Brandler. Traveling overseas, chances are you'll notice that English is spoken all over the place, even in the most far-off corners of the world. For some, the state of affairs brings a measure of disappointment. Getting totally away from our culture is hard to come by. On the other hand, it is easier when you're not struggling in another person's language. So, is it good news or bad news? Is it inevitable that English has become the dominant language of the world? How it became that way and whether it will stay that way is the subject of a new book by David Crystal, a world authority on the English language. He says English is the natural language for many developing countries to adopt.
If you go back to the 1950s, when there were about 50 or so countries in the United Nations, and compare that with today, when there are over 180 countries in the United Nations, and you ask, what has happened to all those countries in the meantime? Well, an awful lot of them are newly independent nations. And in so many parts of the world, such as parts of Africa, for example, these newly independent nations needed a new language to act as a lingua franca. Often a local language wasn't available to them, and the majority of them opted for English. And that, along with some of the other amazing technical developments which have taken place over the last 20 years or so, especially the internet, I suppose, but also international commerce and advertising and so on and so forth, all of this has come together and has made English in a position of preeminence.
You said that the stage was set for English many, many years ago, during the time maybe of Sir Walter Raleigh. Is that really when English had the seed of its power?
I think as soon as a language starts to become associated with a country with any sort of power at all, then it begins its progress around the world. And you can trace the origins of world English back to the first steps that English took when it was associated with the beginnings of the British Empire. And so, yes, the reign of Queen Elizabeth I and thereafter started the progress. Whenever you look at the way in which something has come around the world, something global has happened, whether it be the press or broadcasting or recorded music, popular music, or whatever it might be, you find that these great world movements invariably began either in Britain or in the United States, in other words, the two leading countries where English was the mother tongue.
It also interested me that the ease of a language doesn't determine whether it becomes a global language. I have always thought that English was a very difficult language, but you mentioned in your book that compared to others, it's rather easy. It doesn't have difficult grammar, according to you. It has no masculine and feminine and neutered genders. It has a large vocabulary.
Let's have a look at this one. This is quite a tricky one. All languages are more or less equal in their complexity, I believe. No, the problem is that people learn a language not because it's got easy grammar or difficult grammar. That doesn't seem to be very relevant. I mean, if complexity was the issue, people actually wouldn't learn English because of its quite complicated spelling system. You know, that would put people off all over the place. So people have learned English regardless of the complexity of the spelling, regardless of the complexity of the grammar, regardless of the vocabulary. And why do they learn a language then? They learn a language because it gives them something they want. Gives them something they need. It gives them access to markets, perhaps. It gives them access to corridors of power. And people, when they're, if you're waving dollar bills in front of their nose, people will learn an awful lot of spelling and an awful lot of grammar in order to be fluent in a language that will help them to get those dollars.
Are there dangers inherent in having one language so dominant in the world?
Yes, there are. And this is a very serious other side of the coin. And the danger is that the increased role of the language will start to make people not want to learn other languages or not want to use them. And in many parts of the world, we've seen the growth of English coincide with a deterioration in the number of other languages that are available. Australia is a very good example, where the number of Aboriginal languages have been reducing year by year. There are very few left now compared to the hundreds that were around some years ago. This isn't just a problem for English, of course, it's a problem for any language that's a major local language. For instance, in South America, Spanish and Portuguese, between them, have killed off, in a sense, a very large number of native Indian populations and languages from those parts of the world. English hasn't been the wicked godfather there, if you like. Other languages have. And around the world, though, there is always this risk that doesn't have to be a question of language death. The languages are under threat, but with a great deal of effort, it is possible for them to survive. I come from a part of the world where this has happened. I come from Wales, and in Wales, Welsh was under a very strong threat from English for many decades. And since the 1960s, the Welsh people, having become aware of this threat and become anxious about it, then started to do something about it. And the current position of Welsh in the 1990s is that it's really in quite a safe shape. But that example is, I think, rather exceptional. In many parts of the world, the other languages haven't been able to stand up to the threat of domination of a language like English. And unfortunately, it seems to be the case that over the next 100 years, something like half the languages of the world are likely to disappear as a result of the domination of these originally imperial languages.
Since English is going to be the language that everybody seems to want to learn, and it is going to be the lingua franca, should American children and English children be learning foreign languages? Is there some reason for them to do that, or would it be better time spent perfecting their English?
This is a very good question. If you're trying to sell your goods to a country that you haven't sold to before, or to maintain your position in such a country, why are they going to treat you in a favored way? Well, the answer is this, that if you can demonstrate to them that you are prepared to take their country seriously, to take their culture seriously, to take their language seriously, then maybe you might just get an edge in competition over your other competitors. And as we look around the world at the moment, we find this actually happening over and over again, that people, that governments, that countries, that institutions, businesses, who have actually taken the trouble to learn something of the language of the country that they're trying to sell to, actually turn out to do rather well in terms of building up relationships, making contacts, and all the things that are necessary before a contract is actually signed. So there are all sorts of reasons where I think that it is absolutely critical for people to avoid a kind of complacent, monolingual, inward-looking attitude about language, and to open up to the outside world and to say we can learn a great deal about ourselves by learning about others. Seeing the differences with others actually teaches you something about yourself as well as about them. So there are these humane reasons for learning foreign languages as well as the economic ones. All in all, any new development that makes people respect foreign languages and find the time to learn them can only be to the good.
David Crystal, thanks so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.
David Crystal's new book is called English as a Global Language. He spoke to us from the BBC studios in Bangor, Wales.